think we left off last time, just as we were about to begin talking about transliteration, the technicalities of transliteration. You have in the materials this little kuntos that was written by Rav Henkin. Now, unfortunately, there's very little else that deals with these themes in detail, but let me just make a few comments in general. And for the rest, it's essentially the Madame Milsa Le Milsa. I have to first make the very obvious point that it all depends upon pronunciation. I'll give you a couple of examples afterwards. The same name can be written in a variety of different ways, or spelled a variety of different ways, depending upon how it's pronounced. So the $64 question becomes pronounced by whom? When you have the same name that's pronounced different ways by different people. And again, I'll try to give you a couple of examples. But just a few of the general rules, first with regard to consonants, even with names. Number one, no middle name. The middle name is never used when you use a Shem Laz, unless, of course, the person is called by both names, which is not terribly common in the North. It's much more common in the South, particularly with regard to women's names. Mary Jane is very common, things like that. Seldom hear that up North. When, again, they didn't know about the Kabbalistic problems and points, but Mary Jane is one name, not two names. If her name is Mary J, and the J stands for Jane or what have you, it's not part of the name. It's just part of the principle. Number two, you never use a double consonant. Never. You shouldn't use a double consonant. I think last time I pointed out to you that buffalo was muchzak with two pays. It's in contravention of the accepted way, but in buffalo, that is how the city has been muchzak. And a silent letter is simply ignored. Silent letters such as Knoxville, it's not Knoxville, you don't use a kuf. Or in the English name Barbara. And this, again, I don't like these autobiographical vignettes, but I once was sitting with Rav Henkin with regard to a get, and the girl's name was Barbara, and she had brought a ksuba in which the middle aleph was included for Barbara. Rav Henkin, Zecher Lavracha, was a Sagi Noher, and I pointed out to him that the Masadra of the Ksuba, who was a person of some stature at least, had spelled it with three aleph's, and it should have been only two aleph's. And I was sorry I raised the issue in the first place, because he was absolutely certain that the Masada Kedushin heard Barbara, which means, of course, that they must have been calling her Barbara, not Barbara. And now everybody denies that she ever was Barbara, and she was Barbara. I knew very well that whoever the Masada Kedushin was not exactly Dea B'Tiv Gittin V'Kedushin. He didn't know Rav Henkin's principles of transliteration. But Rav Henkin, Meroiv Chasidusa, he took it seriously until he was, you know, Machria, that the old name was the Shtakach, and now her name is Barbara, not Barbara. So we came to the same conclusion, but reached it in different ways. I have never heard any girl being called Barbara. It's a silent A in English, and therefore is ignored for purposes of the Ksuba. Again, there is no hyphen in the usage that we employ. So names like Ben-Sion or Bathsheba are one name, not two names, meaning they have to be written on the same line, but not as one name. And Ben-Sion is not spelled with an ordinary nun, but with a nun sofis. And there is a space of a moli isktana, like the shear of a yud, between the two names. So biblical names. The accepted practice, there may be das amiyut different, but the accepted practice is that you have somebody whose name is David and he doesn't have a Shem Kodesh. Nobody ever called him David, and he had a bris yesterday, so that the name isn't muchzak. You write it Dalid Vov Dalid, not David, but David, which is what David is, after all. biblical names don't require transliteration. The biblical name is written the way the biblical name is. Shem Kodesh, which is in Tanakh, is written the way it's in Lashon Kodesh. Now, I've given you, Rav Hankins, I will talk about the other sounds in a moment. This is basically for Ashkenazim, it's not for Sephardim. The rules for Sephardim I can't give you because they're not readily available. The only ones that I know are in an article in Torah Shebaal Peh by Rabbi Avadya Yosef. And since he himself wrote a truv in the Yabi Omer that a ksuba written for a Sephardi or an even a Sephardi kihila that has the Ashkenazic transliteration is kosher, I don't think you have to worry about it too much. Basically, and here I am probably at odds with certain Botei Din, but it doesn't depend upon the Chosron and the Kabbalah, or the Sephardim or Ashkenazim. It depends upon the place in which the Ksuva, or heaven forfend, the Get is being written. And I do not think that with your Shtei Botei Din v'Yir Achas, then each Kehillah follows its own practices, where there are no Shtei Botei Din v'Yir Achas, is whichever was Muksak first. Now, in New York, for example, apparently everybody recognizes that the Sephardim weren't Masik anything before the Ashkenazim came, and therefore it was the Ashkenazic transliteration that became Muksak. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no second Kehila of Sephardim in New York. It's very hard to find a Sephardim in the Spanish Portuguese synagogue. There are, you have to look with the Dikas, Chomis likes to find one. There are other smaller shuls that are Sephardi, but I'm not aware they were Maxi themselves as separate Kehillahs. The question is, how are you Maxi yourself as a separate Kehillah? Reb Moshe in one of his shuls says that if you have a separate Shkita, you're an independent Kehillah, and he didn't make it up. It's absolutely correct, or at least it was absolutely correct in Europe. That's when a kehillah had shechita. That was part of the definition of a kehillah. Today, kehillahs don't have shechita anymore. Everything comes from the Wild West. So that there is no identification in terms of a kehillah. There may be identification in terms of a cemetery, but I'm not going to enter into that right now. In any event, I think that in Manhattan, I won't talk about Flatbush, in Manhattan, I think that even if you have a Sephardi, Chosn, and Kala, you should use Ashkenazi transliteration. And the fact that there are Botei Din in Manhattan that don't do that in Gittin is, well, it's just part of the fact. They probably disagree with me, I don't know. I would not be Mesadar Eksuva in Deal using Ashkenazi transliteration. Yes?
Does it go by where you are or where everybody's from?
The place. The place where the thing is being drafted. In the case of the get, where it's being delivered. But since, you know, the ksuba, there's no difference between the ksiva and the series of mokem haksiva. Okay, let me just a few more of these little principles and then we'll go on. The TH sound is not present in the Hebrew phonetic system. Therefore, it's represented by simple tess. Not a tof, but a tess. The problems become with the J. There's no J sound in Lashon Kodesh either, at least among Ashkenazim. I understand that there are some Sephardim who distinguish between a Dalet Degusho, and a Dalet which is not a Degusho, and a Degusho becomes not a D, but a J of some kind or other. But certainly, we, in ordinary Lashon Kodesh, we don't have a J sound. The question is, how do you represent it? There are two different ways of doing this, and again, it depends essentially where you come from and how you do this. In Russia and Lithuania, or better, the people of Russian and Lithuanian extraction generally write it Dalet Zayin. The Polish, Lithuania, Hungarians generally do it Dalet Zayin Shin. I have probably seen more instruments Dalet Zayin Shin than Dalet Zayin, but I write Dalet Zayin, and that's because Rav Henkin and Rav Moshe wrote the Dalet Zayin. they were opposed to using Dalet Zayin Shin because that three consonants without a vowel, and their position was that you don't ordinarily, everything has exceptions to the rule, you don't ordinarily have three consonants without a vowel, certainly not three consonants representing a single sound. Philip obviously gets an ordinary pay at the end, and a similar name would also get an ordinary pay at the end, because the pay sophis is always Einod de Gusha, and you would pronounce it Philip, and since it's Philip, the only pay de Gusha is at the beginning of a syllable, hence it's got to be a simple pay. That's
how do you do the pay in the beginning of that?
Sorry?
How do you do the pay in the beginning of that?
If it's a not a p but a f, no etzer, you use pretty much the p, but at the end you use the other. Now the consonants. Again here it gets a little bit tricky. The comet sound is usually represented by an aleph. At the end of a word, particularly when in Lashon Kodesh, it's a komet hey. It's a komet, and then there's a hey afterwards. Otherwise, if it's a shem laz, it's an aleph at the end, not a hey. That's the difference between shem kodesh and a shem laz. A shem laz gets an aleph at the end of the word to indicate a komet. A shem kodesh, usually feminine names that are kodesh, usually have a hey at the end. Is never an aleph at the end in a shem kodesh that ends in a komets. Now the issue often comes up with regard to a common modern Hebrew name. I use Hebrew in quotation marks. Ilana. Is Ilana spelled aleph yud lamed nun hey or aleph yud lamed nun aleph? And again, the way the girl spells her name is totally irrelevant. It's the way it's supposed to be spelled. The issue is whether Ilana is a Shem Kodesh or a Shem Chol, which I gather the Shem Ilana is the feminine of Ilan. And now, is Elon Kodesh or is Elon Chol? Is it Aramaic? The word Ilon, meaning a tree, does occur in Tanakh. Question is it an Aramaic word which occurs in Tanakh, or is it the Hebrew word? That's a shaila I'm not going to be machria. I suggest you consult Professor Richard White. He's more likely to know the etymology of the word Ilan. But Mayofa Ilan Zeh, I suspect, is Aramaic, even though it's pretty early, but I could be totally wrong. I haven't the vaguest idea. An eitz is a tree in Lashon Kodesh, and it seems to me that it's an Elon in Aramaic. Thank heavens I haven't had the problem, but that's simple nafkamina with regard to it's a Shem Kodesh or it's a Shem Chol. Let's go back to the consonants. A segel is represented by an ayin, usually, and a chirik is represented by a yud. A tzera is represented by the ai sound. I is represented by a tzera, which is then two yuds. The I sound becomes two yuds. Let me talk first about the ayin. The general rule is that the ayin sound, the komets is represented by an ayin. When it's in the middle of a word. When it's at the end of a word, it's usually represented by an aleph. So, fege would be pei yud gimel aleph, not pei yud gimel ayin, even though anybody who reads the Allgemeine Journal would know that they would spell it with an ayin at the end. The fact that you spell it that way in Yiddish has absolutely nothing to do with the way you transliterate for purposes of iksuba. There is one shuv in Reb Moshe in which he says where it's absolutely clear that it's an eh sound, a segel sound, use an ayin at the end of a word as well. The real issue is that the segel at the end, or the chometz or whatever, the aleph or the ayin at the end of the word is very often a syllable that is pronounced very quickly, or the vowel is pronounced very quickly. And it's difficult to hear whether it's a segel sound or a fast chometz sound. So Rav Moshe seems to say that if everybody says pronounces it as a segel, and there's no doubt whatsoever, you could use an ayin, but generally it's an elliptic kind of sound, and therefore it's represented by an aleph. Now, the difference between one yud and two yuds is probably the most frequent psul in transliteration. There are two separate names in Yiddish. One is Leib, the other is Leib, and they're two separate names, Feige and Feige, and two separate names, Kreindl and Kreindl. And some kids are called Leib, and some are called Leib. Leib is spelled Lamed Yud Beis, and Leib is spelled Lamed Yud Yud Beis. And don't confuse me by telling me that everyone in Litteland was named Leib and there was no Leib in Litte, and everybody in Hungary is Leib and there was no Leib in Hungary. That's absolutely true. And those are now two separate names. And you have to know whose name is, well, what is the kid's name, and then when he grows up and you're writing a ksuba, you'll know which spelling to use in the ksuba. That can rise to the level of a Shinui Hashem, and I think you have to be absolutely careful. Let me give you a couple of names where it becomes a bit tricky, simply because the same person is called by different names. The name Adolph, as in Adolf Schickelgruber, is pronounced by people who speak German as Adolf. People who don't speak German or don't come from a German background pronounce it Adolf. Adolf is clearly Aleph Yud. If it's Adolf, there's no Chirik sound and should be an Aleph. Your problem then becomes, what do you do if the person lived all his life in Frankfurt on the Hudson, but he goes to work someplace in Midtown Manhattan, and the result is that in the north part of the island, his friends call him Adolf, and at work, everybody calls him Adolf. So you have to make a determination whether he's Adolf or Adolf. Now, of course, in a get, you would write Adolf, the miscreant Adolf, or Hamachun Adolf, if there's no Shem Kodesh. And which to put first and which to put second, you'll leave to the Masater Haget to figure out. If you're writing a ksuba where it is not min hamukubal to write the miskri or to write hamakuna, in this case it will be the miskri because you're writing this because it's Shem Kodesh. We don't write all the names and cognomens, just one name. You've got the problem of determining how to spell such a name. It's not really a problem with the Adolfs of the world because there are very few of them that don't have a Shem Kodesh. But it does become a problem with a name like Beryl. Beryl is a frequent enough name, and if they don't remember a Shem Kodesh, you may be left with only something like Beryl. Beryl depends upon how you pronounce it. The way I just pronounced it, you would spell it Beis, Ayin, Reish, Lamed. Other people I hear tell spell it Beryl, because they hear the yud as a separate sound, beril, instead of beryl. It depends where you put the accent, at the beginning or at the end. I hear tell that, I haven't heard beryl terribly often, but I have heard the accent at the end, beryl, in which case I hear the ayin sound very clearly between the reish and the lamed. And that requires a good ear. You have to hear how the people are pronouncing it and how the person is known, at least to the majority of individuals. There are other names that can present such problems, but I don't think that we have to go into those in any great detail. The point of all of this is simply to sensitize you to the fact that if you're going to use the Shem Elaz, particularly in the Shem HaMishpochen, that's again, I reiterate why I think Shem Mishpacha should be ignored for these purposes. It only creates problems that you really don't want to have to deal with. You have to know the rules of transliteration, and you're going to have constant problems on your hand. Now, let me go beyond this. Let me talk about the, unless there are any questions you want me to deal with regard to these problems, then let me talk about some of the other things that are on the list. The first thing that I want to talk about in the order of the topics is the word musa. None of the printed forms that I'm familiar with have the word musa. Why they don't have the word musa, I don't know. It's pretty hard to find a place that does that is not a musa, but instead is something less than a musa, although it became an issue about 20 or 25 years ago when they first began writing Gitin in Mansi. The issue is Mansi a musa, is it a city, or is Mansi something other than a city? There weren't as many people in Mansi in those days, and there's an article in Jewish Observer, which I didn't reproduce for you, in which there's a very popular write-up of how they finally were machria not only how to spell Mansi and write Mansi, Mosa Mansi, or Mansi Mosa, the Asva al Nahar, Lake Susan, because it turns out that Lake Susan isn't a lake, but it's a river, but they call it a lake, so what are you going to do? So they were machria to write Nahar, Lake Susan. The years that I lived in Mansi, I didn't know there was a lake, but they discovered the lake, so they were able to be machzikid, because Gitin you don't write in the places that don't have waters. Okay, fine. It's not your particular problem, fortunately, but you have to have the word, or there should be the word, musa. The real issue is, I forgot to bring, I had the Ebenezer out on the table, but okay. The issue is whether you write Musa New York or whether you write New York Musa. I know that in English it's New York City. And one of the issues is when do you write city, when don't you write city. I'm not going to bore you with that. You can read all about it in the Sivas Halach if you want to. In Kansas City they write Kansas, Musa Kansas City. But in New York nobody writes Musa New York. Musa New York City or New York City Musa. The same issue occurs with rivers in Gitin, which again is not your problem. But the issue is, does Musa precede the name of the city, or does Musa come after the name of the city? Now, I've given you a tshuva in the Igros Moshe, and I think that the, I don't know what page it's on, but I think that the relevant sif in Eben Ezer has also been reproduced. The issue here is, for example, in the Get. In the Get, you're right. Mosa, Pliny, whatever, that's the Ramah. Comes along to Bishmuel, and Ramah says he's emphatic. Mosa, Pliny, and not Pliny's Mosa. Says the Bishmuel, that's only if there's no cities. In some cases, you could write a get without the name of the city, but the regularity is that you write it with the name of the city, in which case, says the Bishmuel, you write Mosa, you write Pliny's Mosa, the Yasva al Nahar. Why? And he explains in detail, I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, because the Yatsa refers to the Mosa. It's the city that's on the river. That's why you say Mosa the Yatsa, where you don't have a city, and there's no, the city's not sitting on a river, so you say the city, whatever it is. That's the base Shmuel. Since in Iksuba you don't write the name of the Nahorois, then you would write, according to the base Shmuel, Mosa New York. The Gra says that the Beis Shmuel is not exactly meduyik, and he quotes a number of places where they, as Gemaris, where you have the word Mosa after the city, even though there was no Shem HaNohar because it wasn't a get. But he says, nevertheless, it's Mosa Machzio. Machzio, for some reason, they wrote Mosa Machzio. Now Reb Moshe, therefore, and you have the two of Reb Moshe in front of you, Reb Moshe says that you it's a machlokes, the Gra and the Bishmuel, And he's mafriya like the gra. And he says that you should always write ex mosso, putting the word mosso after the name of the city, as the gra points out, was in the majority of cases in the Gemara. Now, Rashi thinks the machlokes is the gra and the Beis Shmuel. He's being machriya like the Beis Shmuel. I'm sorry, he's being machriya like the gra, which was not at all uncommon in Litta. Rashi many times is machriya like the gra keneged the Ramo. In Poland, that wouldn't have flown. In Poland, they would always be machriya like the Ramo against the gra. And in this case, not exactly the Ramo, but it's a Beis Shmuel who is interpreting the Ramo. Not clear that they would follow the gra in such a case. Lanias daiti, there's no machlokes here. Lanias daiti, the gra is simply saying, and he goes, that's why I wanted the text. He says that in Gitin, you write in a particular way, and he uses the word Gitin, and Gitin it's always Mosso afterwards, even when there's no Shem Hanar. And then he quotes, the Gemara says that you do find Mosso Machsio, and there he doesn't bring it in the context of Gitin. I think what the Gemara is telling you is a principle, and that is, and it's a principle you find in other halachas with regard to Gitin, and that is that a get is called a Sefer Krisus. And that there is one style in writing books, and there's another style in colloquial language. In writing for posterity, you are very careful with usage and language. And the tikkun haloshen, for purposes of things like a sefer, is to write the mosa after the name of the city, whereas in the Igera Sholem or some other writing which isn't called a sefer, it doesn't make any difference. That's how I understand the gra. I understand that the extent of the machlokes between Shmuel and the gra is only in Gitin and it doesn't apply any place else. But be it as it may, it's one way to know whether the Masadr Kedushin has at least a nodding familiarity with Gitin Kedushin or not. If he leaves out the word Mosa, you know that he doesn't. If he puts in the word Mosa, he puts it before the name of the city or after the name of the city, doesn't make very much difference. Ramesh would say, always write New York Mosa. If you ask me, I would write Mosa in New York, but as long as the word Mosa is there. Okay? Now, I think I point out last time that many forms have I shared by Merakat Zafainis. There's no reason for it, and came from somebody who did not have a reputation as any great Talmud Chacham, so we can talk about that. One other little point I should make, that I've been talking about Mosa. You have the option of writing ear. If you look in the Nachla Shiva, you will find, not in the Ksuba if I remember correctly, but in the Ksuba, the Irkasa and all the other documents that he gives you a text for, he always uses ear rather than Mosa. And I forgot which city he lives in. He always gives you the same city. But he uses ear, and ear always comes before the name of the city, not after the name of the city. It's in Aramaic that Mosa follows the name of the city. So, again, the challenge is, what's a city in Halacha? That was a big deal in Mansi. Didn't I talk about the Aruch HaShulchan last time with the Kretchem? The Kretchem is not a Mosa. And his big problem was he doesn't know how to translate Kretchem in Aramaic. And I think I talked about a country club. Can I talk about that? That's the big problem. They sometimes use the word Kfar for something that was less than a city. What is the minimum population to be called a Kfar? I'll leave that to Masadr Gittin to worry about.
Mosa and Yer have the same.
Mosa, it's a translation. Well, Mosa technically means place in Aramaic, but it's used only if it's a city. However, if you were to write Mosa for a Kfar, I don't think it passes. If you write Ir for a Kfar, you've got a bigger problem on your hands. But basically, the term Mosa was reserved for something that was regarded as a city.
So let's say Tina, which is not a city.
The problem is what makes a city a city? Who says a city is a city? Whatever. I don't know about that. In New Jersey, in particular, you got all kinds of jurisdictions that aren't cities, they're not, I don't know what they are. Even in New York, you have townships and villages within the township and what have you. Where the place is Mursak, it's Mursak, whatever it was. Gator gave the example of Brooklyn. Brooklyn is no longer a city. But we still write Brooklyn because it was once a city. Kew Gardens is not a city, it's part of Queens, and they still write Kew Gardens because Kew Gardens was once not part of Queens. It was an independent municipality, so it was Mursak from a long time. I have no idea what Teaneck is or Teaneck isn't. Their problems arose in Baltimore County, outside of the city of Baltimore. You've got all of the little places that have names, but it's not part of any incorporated municipality, or at least so I was informed. Now the problem is, what do you write? You don't write county. It's like a Shema Medina, what have you. So it's a problem. And again, I'm not going to resolve that problem today. The same issue arose in Toronto, in Thornhill. Thornhill is a big shul in Thornhill, to all intents and purposes. It's part of Toronto. It's basically a shchuna. It's another neighborhood, like Borough Park, like Flatbush. The only problem is that it's a separate municipality. In Canada, they have what's called police townships. And it's got a certain standing in Halacha, and it's not Thornhill. It's Vaughan, I think. Who knows what it is. And not only that, but it was Mursak for Ksubis in the days when it had its own name, and everybody recognized it as being different. So somebody told them that it was told Rav Henkin, because they all quote Rav Henkin. It's like in computer, it depends on what information you feed it. They told him that it's unincorporated municipality near Toronto. So he told them to write Thornhill Hasmucha le Toronto, which is perfectly fine. It's in accordance with all the principles. If they had told him that it was, whatever this is, a police township or whatever they called it, and that to the bargain it was once Mursak, not as Thornhill but as Vaughan, and Vaughan is still known because Vaughan is still a police township or whatever, you end up with a different conclusion. But that's, these are all problems. The problems now, we can't be machria all the problems this afternoon. The point is, like a shoychit, he doesn't have to know the answer. If he says ha'isim stapik ha'shoyel, it's good enough. Okay, let me talk just a little bit more about other little provisions that you have to know with regard to the ksuba. One point I want to emphasize, and that is there should be no spaces in the ksuba. If there are spaces in the text, it's a ksav that's royu lihizdayev. And if it's royu lihizdayev, it's posel in itself. The simplest, again, I don't have, there you have a text of a ksuba here someplace. You have, for example, a space in which you're supposed to write mono or mosai. This is a ksuba yerkes. Okay. And here you have, there's a ksuba. Here you are. Page 206. Kesef Zuze. And we are supposed to write in. Meya or Mosai. Dechozi lechi. But look how much space he gave you. He has a patach, a long patach. Then the eight, which of course is supposed to be notes to this, followed by another patach. If you give me this, I will write Mosai before the eight and leave the space blank, and then if I'm the Kala, I will afterwards put in three letters. Aleph. And look what I've done here. That's Roy Lizdaev. It's really Roy Lizdaev. There's only one thing you can do if the printed form has such a long line. It doesn't have the eight in the middle. There's only one of two things. Either you can write Kiddush Levon Asius, as they call it in Yiddish, write very big letters. Or you write the way you write, and you take out a credit card and a pen, and you put the credit card in the middle of the space, and vertical in the space, and you draw a pasuk on top of it. So you have an effect filled in the space, so nobody can write there. That's the only way to deal with those spaces. And you, yeah?
Can you explain it? You write the, after you
I meant horizontal, not vertical. You, after the mayor must sign, you put a piece of plastic and you put it a little bit higher in the space, halfway up, and you take a pen and you just draw a line. You may have to make two such lines if necessary, if they're big letters and you don't want to be Roy Liz Dyke. And you're going to have to do that pretty much every place there's a space. Yeah? You can squiggle it, but it doesn't look nice. It may feel like if you squiggle nicely, then squiggle instead of a patach, whichever you like. Yes.
Does it matter where the blanks are? Like the bottom line, I think there is.
I'll talk about the bottom line in a second. This is why I strongly advise that you tell the Chosen Kala not to use a calligrapher to make them a ksuva. Why in the world people want an artistic ksuva, I have no idea. The ksuva is no more romantic than an insurance policy, and why would anybody want to hang it on the wall? But you go to museums, you find ksuvas that come with all kinds of designs around them. You won't find a ksuva with done the way these people do it. But they make ksuvas. Not only do they use calligraphy, which is a separate problem, but they have it in all kinds of different shapes. The cheapest way is an oval, like a robin's egg. They usually do it in pale blue or whatever. Don't ask me why. I have seen a ksuba in the shape written. A ksuba written like a dove. You read it all, and it looks like a bird when you're all finished. But that's easy. You can write anything you want in all of that. That's totally unacceptable. There are ways of doing it. If you want to, but Dafkin, waste money, you can make the artist fill in all the spaces around, or fill in whatever is there with gold leaf, I don't know, make it more expensive. Do whatever you want. But the real problem is that, yes, this isn't the Sefer Torah, and if the right side of the gimel going down isn't longer than the flat part, it's not going to passle, but it's supposed to have the tzur of an ice. And if it doesn't have the tzura of an ice, you don't use the lechatchila. Which tzura, I don't really care. It doesn't make any difference. Even the get, we don't use ksav shuris. But there is such a thing as a tzura of an ice. I have seen ksuvas in which I'm not sure that I can recognize the tzura of ice. And if I can't recognize the tzura of ice, it's not an occasion in which I need a tinik lechakim v'litipish to come and tell me what the ice looks like. That's not how you write. That's how you're supposed to write. Artists, for their reasons, they want to be innovative, so they write letters in a manner that they think is artistic. That's a problem which is easily resolved. The problem of the spaces and the shapes is much less easy to resolve. Now, the real problem is that even if you warn the artist in advance, et cetera, and now he's gone to work, and then he brings it to you, and it's not acceptable, these people are out a couple of $100, and they get very upset, for good reason. That's why I strongly urge them not to try it in the first place. I see no purpose. If they are using a calligrapher, make sure that you give the calligrapher the nusach and tell him everything that he's got to know, including the proper spelling of the names, et cetera, and not to leave spaces and who knows what. Yes? There's no problem. You want to do it on the computer and print it out? Yeah, it's the easiest thing in the world. How come people don't do it? Because they want something that, quote, looks nice, close quote. Now, I recommend the Art Scroll Ksuba. In fact, before Art Scroll was Art Scroll, they were a printer. And the first thing they printed was a Ksuba. And the Ksuba is still available. I don't know if they sell it anymore. But I call the Art Scroll Ksuba, and it's available in any bookstore. It comes in two versions, one for Psula and one's not for Psula. It's a rectangle, it's got a nice margin, and it's got a color around it, but the rectangle is a rectangle, and they knew what they were doing, or whoever set the type for them knew what they were doing. I have on occasion taken this, particularly as a Cheney, where they don't really care about these things. Taken a form and Xeroxed it. What's wrong with the Xerox form? Xerox form costs nothing. The form that they sell costs $2 or $3. What do I need this for? But if they want something that looks nice, so you have the art scroll form out there, which is in Technicolor, what have you. But it's no better than what you can do on a computer.
And
sure.
Do you have a word processor filling in those blanks prior to the wedding? Filling the blank fields.
You mean you want to make it once on the word processor and fill it in every time, and it will adjust the line. It'll justify the margins. Yeah. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with it. Fine. It just doesn't look very artistic. Unless you know how to, if you're a graphic designer, you can start charging as a calligrapher. Probably higher fees than the rhythmical fees. Okay. More with regard to the piece of paper. You asked about the last line. The last line is in one of I have two texts here. I have something called 205, the Bir Haksuba, which on the bottom it says in the Roya the Shimush Haksuba, and the other one says doesn't say anything, just the wedding in Haksuba. There's plenty wrong with the one on page 206, but one thing they managed to get right. If you will look on the bottom, you will see that the words Hakol Shor V'Kayim are in bold block letters. Will somebody tell me why it's written all three? What's Hakol Shor V'Kayim mean?
Everything's as it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and if I don't write that, so what?
It's right inside.
So what?
Right inside. You can write anything else underneath.
Precisely. The Hakol Shor V'Kayim is nothing more than surplusage, to use legal language, or what is called colloquially boilerplate language. It doesn't mean a thing. It's there to fill the empty space so that nobody can go and fill in whatever they like on the last line. That's why if you look at the last line, page 205, look what happens to Hakol Shor V'Kayim. They managed to ruin everything by starting the line with Hakol Shor V'Kayim, and there's three quarters of a line that's absolutely empty. So the only thing you can do with something like 205 is to take out your credit card and pen and the same thing, and you're right. That's what the Hakol Shor V'Kayim, on many ksubas that you'll find in museums, you will see that the Hakol Shor V'Kayim has letters like a hey and a chof and a resh. Those letters can be elongated to fill the space. You justify the space by making the letters longer. So that's another little problem. Now, the Simas Eidim should be right after, and it should be signed Reuven ben Shimon Eid, and second name. And I strongly urge that if you have Eidim, to ask them to sign their names on a napkin first, so that they know how to spell their names correctly when they sign the ksuba, because otherwise you may find yourself rewriting the ksuba. Now, with regard to the Eidim, the way they sign their name is not as significant as the name of the chosn of the kala. Eishinu Hashem, the name of the chosn of the kala, compass of the ksuba. If people sign their names the way they generally sign their names, you don't even need a name. We have an Amir who used to use the sign of a fish, and that was his chasimah. But many of these Eidim never sign their name as in Shem Kodesh at all, except when they've been asked to sign the ksuba, in which case you've got to teach them how to sign their names. And you teach them correctly, knowing how to spell the names, etc., etc. Like if his name is Leib, you don't tell him to sign it Lamed Yud Yud Beis. You tell him to write it Lamed Yud Beis. And he will tell you, but he writes to his father in Yiddish, and he signs it Lamed Yud Yud Beis, and you tell him it's very nice when you write to your father. But when you write an eight on the ksuba, you spell it Lamed Yud Beis. In the Morgan Journal, you can be lied after 120 years in an obituary, but here it's Lamed Yud Beis. Okay? On the Matseva, you'll pass with the Shilas. That's when they come with the Shilas. Here, here all you get is trouble. But afterwards, for the Matseva, that's the really big, that's the really crucial Shilas you'll get. Okay. Now, what else? The other little point that I should make is with regard to the phrase dechozi lechi midu raiso, and you will see in the Nachli Shiva and anybody else who writes about these things, that for a psulo you write Mosayim Zuz, Dechozi Lechi Midereisa, for an Almona Grusha it's Meya Zuzim, Dechozi Lechi Miderabonon. That's if you're an Ashkenazi. If you're a Svardi, they write Dechozi Lechi Miderabonon. Now, the machlokes is not whether we're paskening that exubis drabonon, it should make absolutely no difference to the mesader haksuba whether the halacha is like the Rambam or the halacha is not like the Rambam, drayser, drabonon, what's the difference? The difference is that these are different coins. A zuz drayser is a biblical coin, which is eight times a zuz drabonon. Therefore, comes from Avad Yosef, and he quite correctly, although in application we'll see in a minute, he cries bitterly about the Ashkenazi Mesadri Kiddushin in Eretz Yisrael, who write the Chosi Lachim Midereise when the Chos and the Kala are both from the Eidot HaMizrach. And he says, in effect, that they're being Meitzi Momen from the Chos and Shulei Gidin. And he's right. They were Machriyot Zadrabanan. And if you go to their Besdin, the Besdin would Mechayev Zuzi Drabanan, whatever the value is, which is much less than the Zuz Dereise. The short answer to the problem is that if the Chosin is told in advance and is willing to accept the higher amount, you can write the more than sixpence. If he's willing to accept the value of a Zuz Dereise instead of a Zuz Drabanan, it's no worse than Tosis Ksuba. But if the parties are both Svardim, it probably is not appropriate to do this, certainly not in a kehillah in which the normal ksuba is not necessarily the Mosayim, which is Chosi Lechi Midereise. It's otherwise arguable that in an Ashkenazi kehillah, whether he writes it or doesn't write it, he may be obligated to the Minhag HaMedina. But again, we don't have to enter into all of that. It's easy enough to explain to the Chosin. Or even to write the Chosi Lechi Midrabanan, if she thinks she's entitled more, let her adjudicate in the Beis Din at the proper time. Okay? So that is more or less all I want to say about the text. I urge, I don't want to spend time on it, but you just, save yourselves a little bit of embarrassment. Number one, the value of the ksuba. How much is the total value of the ksuba? Rabbi Kellermer, in the little compendium on the ksuba that I put in the Nahar Makremis at the beginning, has a line-by-line analysis of the ksuba, as well as a table at the end, which will tell you the value of the zuz according to Rabbi Avraham Chaim Noy, and according to the Rambam, maybe a few more shittas, and then we would know how much silver a zuz weighs. You take out the New York Times and find out what the morning fixing in London was, and you know how much Mosayim zuz are worth today. The other issue there, and I'm not going to talk about this, is that you've got a ksuba, you have Tosis ksuba in the dunya, and you've got Sukukim Kesef at the end. Does the Sukukim Kesef include the Mosayim zuz? It says Hakol Kibolov. Is this a sum total, or is that the total only of the Tosis ksuba and the dunya in addition to the Mosayim zuz? Look again in Rabbi Kellermer's Sefer. But it's ambiguous, and it's machlokes hapaiskim, so it's there. I'm not sure that you have to tell the chosid it's machlokes hapaiskim, but if he asks, you certainly have to enlighten him in one way or another, so it's a good idea to know. Okay? Yes?
When the Hayim sign the line at the end of is there a necessity to put a line after their names?
No. No, you don't have to put a line after the chsim mosayim. That's not necessary.
Because sometimes they'll have, as with some examples there, there's a very long line that says aid at the end of the line. Has that. Is there necessary to join the names?
No, but the Eidim L'chatchila should write the Ayin Dalet themselves anyway. It shouldn't be in the text. And if they write Ayin Dalet after the name, the fact that it's in the printed teface at the end doesn't make any difference. Okay, now let me talk about a rather delicate issue. And that is a Kala who was never previously married, but she's clearly not a psula. I said clearly not a psula. Sometimes it's clear and sometimes it's not clear. I'll begin with the most egregious example, if you have a Kala who is 8 months pregnant and it's perfectly visible to all concerned, I don't think you should write Sultada. We do not accept the principle of immaculate conception, even though Halacha clearly recognizes it as an empirical possibility without benefit of a miracle. That's not the Zambati. But it's not what's happening. So in that kind of a situation, I don't think it's appropriate at all to write Sultada. Once upon a time, not too many years ago, I told people that if you have a Kala who is not a Psula and you happen to know it, there is no obligation to disclose it, and you can write Psul Tadah, but get two Edim who have no personal knowledge of whether she's a Psula or not, and that way you've avoided all problems. To the Edim, she has a Cheskes Kashrus, and you have no obligation to inform the Edim differently. Now, I have to qualify that in a number of ways. Number one, I presume that the Chosin is aware of the fact that she's not a Psula. If not, there are serious problems, and the Chosin has to be informed. But assuming the Chosin knows and couldn't care less and is willing to accept Masayim Zuz, the Chosin Chim Midaraisa, even though it may not be what she's entitled to, the Edim can sign this, and there is no problem whatsoever. Problem is, can the Edim sign this? And if you are one of the Edim, we'll talk about that a little bit later, can you sign it if you know it's a sheker? I gave you a number of sources dealing with this. First of all, the Shita, the most Rishonim, with the exception of one of the Bali Hafesis, maintains that there's no problem Mechzik Yishikra other than in Maisa Bezdin. That the fact that something is false, as long as it isn't part of a fraud, and if the Chosin knows that she's not a psula, then there's no fraud involved, there's no problem. In the problem of Midvar Sheker Tirchok, I don't see as an issue at all. Unlike contemporary mores, in Halacha it's Mutl Shanais Mitnei HaSholem, and certainly Mutl Shanais in cases of Pagam Mishpoche. If you're allowed to tell your wife that the dress she bought on sale and can't return is beautiful, even though you think it's ugly, because there's nothing to be gained by telling her how much you dislike it, then you can certainly write Psul Tadah in order to spare her the embarrassment and whatever Pgam Mishpoch is involved. The problem is, when there's no embarrassment, no Pgam Mishpoch, what's the heter for the Dvar Sheker Tirchok? But in general, I don't see any problem with regard to this. Even writing Psul Tadah in the Ksuba and the Chos Ilachim Midaraisa, etc., etc., provided that the Chosin is aware of this. The problem, and it becomes increasingly serious, is a situation in which you get up and you did what you're supposed to do. You may even have known that she wasn't a psula, but you figure nobody else does. But they confided in you, rabbinic confidentiality, and you're not going to go disclose it, and you took my advice, and you're a psul tadah, and you read the ksuba, and the whole place breaks out giggling. I consider that comparable to the Kala who's 8 months pregnant. I don't think you have to enter into that kind of a charade. Now, what can you do under those circumstances? Well, the first thing that you do, and here I gave you a couple of sources, you instead of psul tadah, you have to write bul tadah. I think that's going a little bit too far. But the achronim say that you can write plenis tadah. Now, you probably don't speak Yiddish, or if you do, you don't speak my brogue. In my brogue, men often refer to their wives as mein plenister. Not plenistida, but my plenista. Lithuanian pronunciation. But it's Aramaic, it's not Yiddish. Plenista is a woman. This is my woman, my plenista. And they're telling you, right, plenistida, a woman. And you then write, we'll see what to write in a second. Now, you can write that, and under the kuppa, if you want to read sultada, be my guest, but if the whole problem is that everybody knows she's not a psula, you don't gain very, very much by reading psula tadah. You can skip the word. Or you can, instead of plain istado, you can write itzdado. I haven't found that in the Chorin, I made it up. But I didn't make up the word. Itzdado is this woman, whoever she is. That's not taking a position. And then if the chosin agrees, you can write the mosaim zuz, the chosin lechi midaraisa, who cares? It's tesis chuba, whatever it is. And you've been saved embarrassment, not only of the kala, but of yourself. Because if everybody knows that she's not a psula and you write psul to do, you look like the fool. So that's why my position has changed over the years. I am now much more likely to advise people to write it's the door, plain it's the door, than to write psul to do in various circumstances. And that's very much dependent upon the contextual situation. What is the norm and what is expected and what's really going on here. Let me add one thing, and that is, while I said at the very beginning I don't see any real objection to the sultado if nobody knows any different and the chosin agrees, there's one circumstance in which I would never write sultado. I might read it, but I wouldn't write it. Now again, you don't have to read what's written, and that is when I know that she was a novellus lakum. If she was an novellus la'akum, and I write psultado masayim zuz, in the future somebody can pick up this document and assume that if anyone here has signed it, and you're all yedeim b'tiv gitin v'kiddushin, if you signed it, if she was a psul at the time of the marriage, then she's clearly mutter to a kohen, and why should I investigate further? Whereas you know that she's also a kohen. That's why, if she's also a kohen, at least wave a red flag. The red flag is that you didn't write psultado, that you wrote itzdo, plenistado, whatever you wrote, so that the mesader haget will know to warn them that she's also to a kohen, and that the ptur will read that she's mutter to everybody except to a kohen. Actually, she'll be also a kohen anyway. But forget about a get, which is clearly going to be also a kohen. You're dealing with a second marriage after the first husband has died. When she pulls out the first ksuba, nobody sees any impediment to marrying the kohen. If it says it's the door, but it's the door, this should be a red flag to the second Masadah Kedushin, who should now investigate why did you write that in the first place, and he'll discover whatever it is there is to discover. Yes? Gieris, you write the year to though. I thought I didn't have to tell you that. And don't try to hide it. There's no reason to hide it. Sorry? The year to though, you write the year to though. If she's a Gieris, you write the year to though. Okay? Now, there's another wrinkle to all of this. This problem, you find very few references in the Achrayim. The problem that you find in the Achrayim is to what they call Bulas Atzmai. Promiscuity didn't occur to anybody, but that a chosin and kala during the period of the engagement, that they couldn't be oimid b'yitzrom, that occurred already, and that you find in Achrayim. That's called bulas atzmai. What do you write in the case of bulas atzmai? So I gave you a chsam sefer, and he in turn quotes a dogma of Mahova. He says that he used to write mosayim because that's the ksuba of a mafuta. And a mefuta is entitled to mosayim, but it's only chozichim midarabona, not the raisa. She's entitled only to mosayim, but she's entitled to mosayim like a mefuta, but it's in the ksuba, it's the rabona, not the raisa. And the dog, and then he says he changed his mind after he saw the dog of Meravova, who said that's only to a mefuta who is a naro, not a mefuta who is a vigeris. And we don't really have a mefuta who is a naro anymore. They're always a bakeress, therefore says it's not safe, he doesn't write Messiah anymore. Good. But comes along Ramesha, and Ramesha has a long tshuva in which he says that the dogma of Rav is right, but lav mitamei. And he proceeds to talk about not the standard case of a bulas atzmai, but he talks about somebody who has been married bar koyis, or one way or another, and he has a kind of a parallel in the kiddushin of a kotna and a ktana. How it works doesn't really make any difference. Or a geir and a geiris, who are both megayir after they had been living together. There, the ksuba is masayim, because the general principle is it's al das nisuin rishayim. It's just a continuation of a marital relationship, and this is what the parties intended, whatever the reasoning is, isn't terribly important. Reb Moshe Meiroiv Chesidusai takes it for granted that a Bulas Atzma, if he's marrying her yet afterwards, he clearly wanted to marry her from the very beginning. And this is clearly like Nisuin Rishonim. And he's writing what she would have been entitled to had this been the original Nisuin, so she's entitled to Mosaim, and there's no problem with writing Mosaim. That is a case, there may be such cases, where you, and it happens all the time, that you have, this is where it becomes socially very, very awkward, where the chosen and you know, the giveaway is when they bring you a marriage license and ask for the address. The address of the chosen is whatever it is, the address of the kala, and it's the same address. Now, it could be perfectly legitimate. It could be neither the chosen's address nor the kala's address, but they rented a new apartment that they're going to move in tomorrow morning, and they gave you the new address. It can also be something quite different, that they've been sharing the same address for a period of months. Not only have they been sharing the same address, but you're the only one who doesn't know it. Everybody present knows they've been sharing the same address. And you know, we know what's happened at that address. So there may be situations in which it's a bulas atzmai, and she was a psula when she moved into that address. I suspect that when you have that kind of a situation, that this is not the first time that this woman has spent the night under a roof with a male other than her husband, and therefore it's not a bulas atzmai, but an ordinary bul tado. In any event, that's the problem. And how to resolve it depends very much upon the contextual situation at this point in time, when it's more or less common knowledge. I think that that itzdador plenistador is perfectly appropriate, but I think that the chosin should be told that the 200 zuzim, the chos of the chimi deraisa, is in the form of chesis ksuba, and of course he agrees to assume the higher value of the ksuba. He may ask you, and how much is it? That's why I told you, arm yourself in advance by trying to figure out how much it is. It seems to me that even with the inflation in the rate of silver, and even given the chazonis is sheer, the last time I checked with the tesis ksuvi, with all the chumras, it doesn't end up to be more than $10,000, which may be a significant sum, but it's not astronomical. It's also not, as some amoris wrote a number of years ago, that is de minimis, no more than $25. It's a lot more than $25. That was in the case, in the context of a court case, telling the court not to worry about what the ksuba is worth. Okay? Anything with regard to this? Let me go and go to the next problem. We're already finished with the ksuba, but we now have certain problems. Oh, no, I'm sorry, we're not finished with the ksuba. We have one more thing with regard to the ksuba. The other thing we have with the ksuba is the word vikonino that's here in the teifis. And you will see great production made of the fact that after you have the Kabbalah's Kenyan, the photographer is taking his picture, the Masada Kedushin takes out his pen, and he either writes the word Bekanino, or he fills in the kuf of Bekanino, make it easier for him by writing the kuf without the regel, and he fills in the regel of Bekanino, and after all, when did I say he does this? Not after Chesimus Eidim, after the Kabbalah's Kenyan. And after all, how can you write to the Kenina when there was no Kenina? And we're back now to the problem of Mechzei Kishikro. Now, the problem of Mechzei Kishikro I dismissed a little bit earlier. I don't think it's really a problem, number one. Number two, I don't really understand what this is all about. Writing the konino before the chsima so'edim to me is less of a problem than writing the chach omar repleni ben pleni chesandanon to this young lady, havis lead into, and it's siyas moras pleni spas pleni, the havis lead into. What do those words mean? That the chosen told the kala, be you my wife, kadash meshav yisrael. I didn't hear him say kadash meshav yisrael. He may have said, I want you to be my wife, he proposed. I'm sure he didn't use the phrase Kadash Meshi Yisroel. Kadash Meshi Yisroel, he says under the chuppah. and Svias Moras Koinis. The Havis Leilinku, she agreed and became his wife. That's Sheker V'chozo. She's not married yet. The Edim are signing she's married. How can you sign she's married? Well, if you can sign she's married, I don't see what's wrong with having the word V'konino printed before you made the kinyan and before they sign. It's no problem at all. It's not even Mefsik Yeshiva. The secret to all of this is the Ran in Gittin, and it's the secret of the tasting that we use with regard to all shtaris. Every shtar that we have is a sheker, because the shtar says that something happened. Reuven lova mona miplenin from Shimon, and he has to pay it back in kach v'kach. He didn't borrow it. He doesn't write this after he borrows it. When he goes to Shimon and says, I want to borrow $100 from you, Shimon, Reuven says, well, of course I'll lend it to you if I need an IOU. So what does Reuven do? He pulls the IOU out of his pocket and he gives it to Reuven. And lo and behold, it already has the chsim ha-sa'edim. Where did the chsim ha-sa'edim get the right, where did Edim get the right to sign? When they signed, it wasn't true. Reuven hadn't even agreed, much less given Shimon the money. The answer is that every shtar that we use contains an enthymeme. If you don't know what an enthymeme is, it's an argument that has a hidden premise. This is a legal instrument with a hidden premise. What's the hidden premise? The hidden premise is that when it's yetzei mitachas yad of the beneficiary, if it's produced by the person who gets privileges as a result, you will know that the facts that are recited are true, because we have a chazoka. Nobody gives a mal v'shtar unless he lent the money. It's the chazoka that we add to this. How did the shtar get to the malva? The principle is he didn't steal it. If he didn't steal it, then the leiva had to give it to him. If the leiva gave it to him, he'd be an idiot if he gives it to him without getting the money. The chosen is a fool if he gives the ksuba to the wife before she takes the kesef kedushin under the chuppah. And the rov, who takes custody of it while they march down the aisle, has absolutely no right to give it to the kala before the Nesiras HaTabas. Nor why should he give it to the kala until after he's read it under the chuppah? It's the shtar, in effect, is saying that when this is Yetzi Mitachas Yad HaKala, you will know that certain things have happened. You will know that Omar Lahayitz Lahay Psultada Yisrael, he really said it. And you also know that Tzvias Moras Plenius Ben Pleni and Vahavis Leili Intu, she agreed. If she's got it, then the things that we've recited here are true. And if it says V'Kanina, you know it was V'Kanina, because the 280 was signed underneath. And we give it to you, so we give it to you because it's true. I have no problem writing V'Kanina before you sit down, showing up with the word V'Kanina already written in. If you like your little chumris, Gesundtehe, write V'Kanina. The photographer always loves to take a picture of it anyway, right? It's all what it's done for. He loves to take pictures of the row of filling in V'Kanina after the Kabbalah's Kenyan. The only problem is that in the real world, I've seen cases in which they forget. They don't write V'Kanina afterwards. And you end up with a text that doesn't say V'Kanina. Does that make any difference? Don't tell anybody. It doesn't make any difference. But so what? At the Chsimus Eidim anyway, the Chsimus Eidim, we know that the Chosin is Mechuyev Mitzad Hadin. The only problem is the burden of proof. Mochim Shekesim Ksuba, Mochim Shekesim Ksuba. But it always becomes a tumult afterwards. Can you fill in the Kanina? Can't you fill in the Kanina? As if it made a difference whether you filled it in or you didn't fill it in. But the easiest way, to my mind, is to write the Kanina before you show up, so it's part of the Tefis. Okay? That's, yes. And I may as well talk about the Ksuba. I'll talk about, yes?
The space that Kanina is supposed to take up, isn't that going to be Yachal HaZayif?
You may be right, except that if you have everything except the regal, the Kuf, it's not Yachal HaZayif anymore. But if it's a if it's Yochel is die, if you have a real problem, if you didn't fill it in before the Chsimus Reidin, yes.
Were deceased parents any suffixes added for Olam Hashalom, or say Zichron Livracha, anything like that? Is there any indication put in?
It's not the way you write things.
And Shem Shmacha.
I I advise against using Shem Mishpocha. I know there are people out there who insist on the Shem Mishpocha. I explained that last time, didn't I? They're afraid of being Maxi to Reisach and Shimon, Birachas. My answer is, if it's not Musak, there's absolutely no reason I'll look at the Chayshi short. And if it is Musak, use the grandfather's name.
The mother's name sometimes you see.
Oh, no.
Is that a psul? I see the herd.
Yeah, Ben Reuven and Ben Avram and Sor. Yeah. It's not going to apostle. It's not the Musak Hashtar. I don't think I spoke about it last time, but, oh yes, I have to talk about it. I will talk about it in a minute. You use the mother's name only in the case of a shtuki, which is a problem, or if the father's a goy. And otherwise, when you use the mother's name, it creates all kinds of reises. If you use the mother and the father's name, it doesn't create a reis, it just tells me that you're a fool, or you're a fadist, or a feminist, or I don't know what. But it's not the way it was done. And there's no reason to make shinui, but that's not going to puzzle anything. Anything else before I go on?
Well, if there's no father,
you write me Be'abula. Oh, anyway, there's no father, you write me Be'naso. For some reason, I don't know who put this in. I didn't include this. There's a table on page 207. Are you responsible for the table? I don't even know where it comes from. I don't even know where it comes from. But in the case of Gerius, it said not to write Bibei Naso. And to me, that came as a... If you look, it's chart 10. Anolos lay, and they left out Mibei. I don't know why Gerius can't write Mibei Naso. Mibei Abu is only of the father and father's living. If there's no father, and a psula. She's independent, a femme soul. Independent of even unmarried girls are sometimes femme souls in our society, but we ignore that. We assume that every psula for the first time is whatever dowry she brings because her father provided it. That's a presumption of Allah, and you don't have to challenge it. But any other one, it's maybe Nasa. It's her own. She's bringing her own money. Yairus is bringing her own money also. I have no idea where that comes from. And not the Grusha. The Grusha is fine. Lamonu Lagrusha Naso. Ligieris Kaisvim Danolasle, and they left out the word Bain. Then comes the whole business. Ben Bekesa, Ben Bazal, Ben Bafiti, the whole business. They left out the word. Now I presume they did it purposely. Now I have no idea which Achron they're quoting. But if you know, please let me know. But sorry?
There are a few mistakes.
I didn't look at it. I care. That just caught my eye for some strange reason. It caught my eye because it was a bigger square, a bigger rectangle than the other. If there are other mistakes, then it's a Sefer Sheinu Muga. Please take it out and don't print it next time. That's not the Hamadre. Or maybe the new Hamadre. I never.
The
RCA, not golden? Oh, it's a new edition. I don't have the new edition. I never bought a Hamadre.
They give it out.
I
They give it out.
It's my Yerusha from my father's Ephraim Lavrocha, and I was more than once on the verge of putting it into the Seamus and kept it only because it had sentimental value. But and why anybody would buy it, I haven't the vaguest idea. I would give it out. No, it's if you need the Hamadrich, as I said last time, enroll in Sai Sims. You need a Kitzer Nachlis Shiva. That I understand. A Kitzer Nachlis Shiva fits into your little pocket, and you take it out in case you don't know exactly how to write the day of the month, the day of the year, whatever. For that, it'll help you. But, what the Madrich is there for, I haven't the vaguest idea. Okay. An ordinary bench roll has everything else that you need. Let me see. Yes, there were some other things that I wanted to talk about. I just remind myself what they were. Yes. We're still under the Seamus Nixuba. In the case of a Geir, somebody, you asked me about a Geiris, Mibay Naso, definitely. But you write Geir Tado. And the problem is really in the case of adopted children. Now, what I'm not going to talk about, because I discovered the first time I went through this series, that when I talked about adoption, it was a whole session. I'll give you just one sentence. La'ne'az daiti. Adoption agencies have no nemonis whatsoever. Even they tell you that the child is Jewish. I think that la'halocha, they have a din of a non-Jew, which is a kul, not a chumra. If it's a non-Jew, all you have to do is take into a mikveh and be medayar them. If it's a Jew, you may have a problem with a nasufi. That can be even more serious. But people don't like to hear this, so I'm skipping it. I'll talk about cases in which it is known either that the child isn't Jewish and they were megayer him, or in rare cases where the baby's mother was Jewish and is known to be Jewish, and this was given up for adoption for one reason or another. In recent years, meaning in my lifetime, I know of only three such cases. In days gone by, before there was something called a pill, and before abortion was legalized, there were Jewish babies who unfortunately were surrendered for adoption, and it was known they were Jewish. Not through Jewish agencies, but privately it was done. And it was known that it was done. And there you had these problems. But now non-agency adoptions are extremely rare because Jewish girls don't have the babies in the first place. But that's just a sociological phenomenon. Now, the result is that, let me deal with the non-Jewish child first. The non-Jewish child needs gerus. Whether the gerus is appropriate or not appropriate isn't my topic. If the parents aren't shomer Torah mitzvahs, I have grave, grave, grave reservations about being megayer them in the first place. However, if they were megayer them and the gerus is valid, the gerus wasn't valid, you got problems with Birkas Eiros and Birkas Nisuyin. But if the gerus was valid and your only problem is the ksuba, that's small change. So you write Pliny ben Avraham Avinu or Pliny Hager. Either one is acceptable. And I don't know if I gave it to you in the sources. There is a Beishmul Neget Poshut, which may indicate that if you don't indicate in the ksuba that the child is a ger, it may even be possible. But I think that it should be indicated, even to the Evid, it's kosher, and even that is kulahai v'ulai, it certainly should be indicated. Your problem is that we are living in a world in which people, now the pendulum is swinging. There was a time when there was closed adoption, nobody wanted to acknowledge that the baby was adopted, and certainly nobody told the child he was adopted, and now suddenly the Masadra Kedushin, who knows or doesn't know, or is told, finds out one way or another, he's going to be Megala the Sod for the first time. You've got a problem on your hands. However, now, since the pendulum has already swung, most of the children are informed sooner or later that they are adopted, in which case it's only the adoptive parents who are trying to fool the world, and they don't want the world to know that the child is adopted. Now, here again, I don't think that that's correct. I think there are problems with people who can issue in halacha, but I'm not sure we're dealing with people to whom that's a concern. And we're dealing now with the problem of the ksuba. If you write a ben Avram Avinu, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to read ben Avram Avinu under the chuppah. If you write ben Avram, it's good enough. And if it's clear that the father's name is not Avram, who says that the microphone can't malfunction when you're reading this part of the ksuba? We mavliya it, or you skip it. You don't write it, what's going to happen? Don't read it if you don't want everybody to know, but I think it should be written.
Could you read the adopted father's name?
Now, come further. Now, what do you do if, are there any other aces? I started by what you should do. Now, is there any aces? What if he writes Ben Pliny, and it's not his real father, it's only the adopted father? B'di'evet, I think it's kosher. Why? Because we have a lot of sources that the Malav Akosuki Yolodai, Megal Yosef Tech Besai, Soskilu Yolodai, and therefore Serachash Osher is the right they bring. The Posuk calls him Bas Osher, even though it wasn't Bas Osher, it was Osher's wife, he was Megalodai. So B'di'evet, it may be kosher. But remember, there's no reason to be a party to a Sheker. The whole, it just reinforces things that shouldn't be reinforced. I think that it should, the parties themselves should recognize that it's not so. And again, it's not my topic, but Rav Henkin, I don't know if it's reproduced or not, Rav Henkin, who knew all the problems, even before you come to the Ksuva, he doesn't understand this business. You adopt a baby, you tell the baby to call mommy, daddy, tell him to call my aunt and uncle. It's a perfectly fine solution to the problem. There's some people seem to think that there's some onus associated with an adoptive relationship. I once read in a Reader's Digest, because somebody showed it to me after I spoke about these things, Reader's Digest story, there was a cartoon of one kind or another. There were two siblings, and the parents had adopted a child who was now 3 or 4, and as often happened in days gone by, don't ask me to explain it medically, it's easily explainable. These people who've been infertile for years and years, suddenly after they adopt a child, now have their own child. It's called psychosomatic infertility. I made up the term. But whatever, the infertility was a result of a hormonal imbalance, which was totally emotional, and now that they made shalom with the rai and they have only adopted child, so suddenly nature does what nature is supposed to do anyway, because you people aren't getting too upset about things you shouldn't be uptight about. In any event, there is a new child that's born, and they bring home the babies in the bassinet, and the older sibling turns to the mother and says, "Poor kid. He doesn't know that you didn't choose him. I was chosen. I'm special. This is just the luck of the draw. This is what they gave you. So I'm clearly more valuable than a natural child." Okay, that's doesn't have ramifications in halacha, but it certainly should go a long way to assuaging this notion that there's something that's embarrassing about an adopted state. But let me go back now to what you can do under the circumstances.
You were saying that they don't want to say Ben Adam, or they want to be Machliyah.
They don't want to indicate that the child's a ger, number one. And they don't want to indicate, number two, probably more significant, they don't want to indicate that this adopted father is not the natural father. They don't want to publicly acknowledge the adoptive relationship.
So you're saying that there should be no problem with that?
I see no problem with it.
But if they don't want to acknowledge that, then they should be Machliyah, or just say Ben Abraham.
That's the word, yes. If there's no other solution, be Machliyah one way or another. I wouldn't write Ben plainly Shagidler.
Right, but I'm saying if they write...
I'm not sure that it's good enough for the Bishmul and the Get Poshet.
But if they write Ben
in the case
Abraham,
of a Ger.
Yeah. Then is there a problem grieving under the chuppah of the name of the adopted?
If it's not publicly known, no. I don't need the whole world to know that he's adopted, particularly if they haven't told anybody told today. But you want them to talk about it during the whole meal about the fact that he was adopted. This isn't the time to tell the world. It is the time to tell the parties involved. They don't know it, and they should have been told long before. What are you reading for altogether? What's the point of reading? That even makes sense. You're reading basically to make a hefsek between Eris and the suing. You want to get up and read the stock tables of the New York Times. Now, in America, it's become a kibbutz reading the ksuba. Creating reading the ksuba is a shamosis. It's nothing. Don't tell anybody I said it. But what you read, what you don't read, it's not like the Balkir made a mistake and you have to take out a Sefer Torah and read it all over again and give new aliyahs. No, if you made a mistake and read the Ksuba, you don't have to call somebody else up. You should read the Ksuba a second time. It's not a problem. What you read is totally irrelevant. Now, let me go back to how you can deal with such a situation. We'll talk about adoption in the same context. But the same problem arises when you have a, quote, mixed marriage, intermarriage. You've got a non-Jewish father who's clearly not the father. And that's usually not a secret. You don't want it to be a secret, even if they want it to be a secret. So, and this child's not a ger. You're not going to write Pliny Hager. So what are you going to write? This is a child who has a Jewish mother but doesn't have a Jewish father. The proper thing to write is Ben Plainis, the mother's name. If Rav Mori Bar Rochel is cited in the Gemara as Rav Mori Bar Rochel, it should be no embarrassment to anybody else to be called Rav Mori Bar Rochel. If it is an embarrassment, it is to Rachel, who decided to marry Shagetz. That she's the one who did something wrong. As far as the child is concerned, this is fine. Now, that people are not going to fly terribly well either. But there are other ways of dealing with it, and that's we'll talk about some of those in a moment after I talk about what happens if it's a Jewish child, but the identity of the father isn't known, particularly in closed adoption. Who the real father is isn't known. So Reb Moshe's Eitzah, it's a very simple Eitzah, and it's absolutely correct. Ben or Bas, Mishish Nishtakach Shemoi, Vinikro, and now comes the whatever it is, Vinikro Pliny Ben Pliny Shekidloi, or Pliny Ben Pliny Hamagadloi, or even if you don't write Vinikro, better is his Nosach, which is that he's dealing with a girl. And her father's name, Goyish, her father was called Joshua or whatever. So, and they were living together, my parents were living together. So he said to write, Plainis, I'm sorry, the natural father, we didn't know, but the mother was married to Shagas or something. Plainis, Bas Mishin Ishtakach Shmoi, Der Ziko es Atzmo, Keplainis, Bas Yehishua Shegidla. Now that's a mouthful and it won't fit in on the space they gave you. But if you've got your computer, it's no problem at all. You have a whole mouthful. So you write the whole business. You write the facts. What's wrong with the facts? The facts are not, you know, the Yiddish expression, the emes is the best to sheker. Why do I have to look for euphemisms and convoluted ways of saying something which is perfectly straightforward? Whoever the father was, we've long since forgotten. And she would, everybody thinks that she's this guy's daughter. And we're telling you why. Or Hirzikas Atzmo as this guy's daughter. Or Hirzikas Atzmo b'shem Pliny Bas Pliny Shegidlo Kabas. Either one's a perfect way of dealing with it.
And there's the problem with writing Bas Jewish or whatever if it's the father who's not Jewish. To write the father's name, the father is not a Jew.
Everybody thinks that this is her father.
No, right.
Right.
But in the case where it is her father.
Where it is her father.
Right.
And?
It's a problem to write Plonis Bas and then the father's name.
I wouldn't do it. Yeah, I don't think it's a problem. I wouldn't write Yeshua even though it's a Shem Kodesh. I would write Joshua.
Or whatever. I'm saying, whatever.
Even though it contradicts the principle I told you earlier. Yeah.
Well, whatever the name is, I thought you were saying before that you would, that they would write Plony or Plonis Bas, Ben or Bas, the mother.
Right, that's the way it should be done.
Why? Instead of the father?
Because she doesn't have a father. This is a Jewish woman who married a goy, and they had a child. She has no father.
So if that's the case, then when the actual... So you're saying it's not so a problem to write the goy, Shegidlo.
Yeah, it was a goy. It's true.
That's the name of the goy.
Yeah, you want to throw in Hanochri too? I wouldn't like that.
Or whatever.
Right? You can throw it all in.
No, I'm saying not the word of the guy, I'm saying the name.
The name, yeah.
So it's more about to write if the guy, if the person who's not Jewish is the father, it's more about to write the father's name than it is if the non-Jewish father, non-Jewish person raised her.
Start again.
The non-Jewish stepfather versus the non-Jewish father. So you're saying it's less of a problem to write in the name of the non-Jewish stepfather.
Because if the non-Jewish father who didn't raise her, nobody knows about.
Yeah, but let's say they know. Meaning a case where they know and a case where it's a non-Jewish stepfather.
Yeah, you had a woman who intermarried twice.
Right.
And it was public. And it was public.
There are two different cases. I'm just saying, in one case it's the father was not a Jew.
Yeah.
So then you don't write the father's name.
No, write Bas Plenis.
When the father is, we don't know who the father is, but the stepfather is a non-Jew, you do write the stepfather.
I didn't say that. No.
Shegidlo.
No. The natural father was a Jew or a non-Jew.
We don't know. Doesn't matter. We don't know.
Sure, it makes a difference. If the Jewish father disappeared, and she was surrendered for adoption, but she had a Jewish father, and everybody knows she had a Jewish father, then you can write Bas Mishnish Dakar Shemai. Period,
right.
Full stop. Not the mother's name. Bas Mishnish Dakar Shemai.
Right.
We don't know who his father is. No, finished. That's easy.
Right.
Now you've got a different case. Not that you have a Jewish father who disappeared, but you had a non-Jewish father. Biological father.
Right.
Not a halachic father. Now what do you do with this guy? So what you should do is write Pliny Bas Plinius, the mother's name. If you were to write Plinius Shehechziko Es Atzmo Kibas, whoever this non-Jew is, Shegidlo, then it wouldn't be possible, particularly right in Hanover.
Even if it's the biological father.
Well, biolites are irrelevant. There's no biology. It's metabiology.
Right.
Then Halacha is not, she's not a biological father. We don't care about that kind of biology. The biology doesn't make any difference.
Right. So as long as you're not writing Bas or Ben Plony, who's not Jewish.
When you write Bas Plony, the plane is not Jewish, it sounds as if there's a lot of relationship.
Right.
And there isn't. So you have to indicate that in something.
Right.
Okay? Yeah?
Is it fair to write the girl's mother's name or to write Jehoshaphat, et cetera, and all that?
I would write the mother's name in this case. When you have a non-Jewish father and they're living together, you got a mother, they got a mother's name. What's the big problem? That's the easiest way. By far the simplest way, and the correct way. Now, I haven't gotten to the other adoption problems. I'll leave that for next time, I think, okay?